seeking spiritual comfort in probably any other kind of religious organization, one wouldn't have to explain the importance of seeking spiritual comfort. But Unitarian Universalists tend to be very into words and what those words mean, and we want to understand what it means to be spiritual, what it means to offer comfort, and want to make very sure that there's no mumbo-jumbo involved in this, and that I'm not going to go off and get very sentimental with you. Well, I may get a little sentimental, because I believe that we are all seeking spiritual comfort. And by that I mean almost all of us have the perception that we are more than just meat, more than simply our appetites. We all share the same common needs for food, for shelter, for affection, dare I say, for love. And those you might see as simply physical, but they're also spiritual, because we want and need our, what they call in the military, three hots and a cot. We want our meals. We need to have food. But the same gray gruel, day after day, might meet the physical needs. But our need for spice, our need for flavor, our need for salt, for sweet, for sour, for umami, for all of the different areas that affect our senses, is part of who we are beyond simply the physical need. We all need shelter. We all deserve shelter. But most of us do not want blank white walls. We want something else, something more, something that stimulates an aesthetic component in us. I hold that whatever the oldest profession is, the second oldest profession was interior decorating. Because when you go into ancient caves, whether of Pithecanthropus erectus or Homo erectus or even Neanderthal, you find pictures. They've decorated. There are usually men at the hunt, running down the mastodon, hunting the antelope and the deer. In modern times, there is also art, seldom involving mastodon, but sometimes poker-playing dogs and Elvis on velvet. But, you know, it's the same need, whatever your taste may be. We need more than the blank. We need color. We need things that give us some sense of beauty and inspiration, and remind us of the beauty out there in the world, as well as the terrors out there in the world, which I'm sure our early ancestors felt when trying to chase down a mastodon with a spear, and not a very good spear at that. We all need affection, and that's part of it too, and that can be physical, but at its very best, all of this, our need for food, for shelter, for art, for affection, involves elements that are both physical and spiritual. You can meet the surface needs just with the physical, but it's so much richer and so much deeper when we combine them and let these things fill us and fill our hearts and fill our souls and give us a sense of connection, a connection to our food, understanding that it doesn't simply grow on a shelf at the supermarket, a connection to art and those things that inform and inspire us, and I include in that, of course, music as well as the plastic arts, and love and affection, the connecting of people to people in a bond that is deeper than simply the surface, a bond of generosity. It's why we share food. It's why we invite people to come over and see our art, even if it's Elvis on velvet. It's we want to enjoy those things that we enjoy with people we care about. Is that physical or is that spiritual? And my answer is yes, it's both. We are social beings. We need each other. And the paragraph is here, this is not simply compensating for what Barbara said. And we also need to be alone. We need from time to time to withdraw and get away from the noise, to get away from the politics, to get away from the disputes, to get away from even the happy noise of the pitter-patter of growing feet and little tongues. We spent a part of this last week with our grandchildren in Newport, and it was an absolute pleasure. I can completely relate to the pleasure part of family. And it was almost as much pleasure when they got in the car and we waved goodbye and there was silence. Some of the most intimate moments that I spend are moments of silence. In the morning when I have my coffee, I know this is going to be hard for many of you to believe, it's the pre-verbal portion of my day. I don't want to be social before I've had two cups of coffee. I am not chatty. I don't want to talk about what I heard on NPR at 5:30 in the morning. I want to sit there till the caffeine takes over, till I'm just ready. But having my wife in the chair next to me, not talking also, is an immense comfort. We go through lives mostly with people. We need to get away from time to time. We need to withdraw. We need some silence. But we are social beings. We are social beings who find out who we are by how others see us. I know myself not from what I see in the mirror, because the mirror, thank God, does lie. I know some of you know this. This was such a shock when I had my cataracts done and I saw my face clearly. I regretted having the cataracts done, I think. Except the colors were so... I could have done without the focus, but colors were so much more vivid. But I don't learn much about myself by what I see in the mirror. I learn a great deal about myself from what I see in your eyes. And that's true of all of us. Let me say something that might be a little bit philosophically controversial. I think that Descartes got it fundamentally wrong when he said, "I think, therefore I am." I believe that there are no private languages and that we think in words and we think in ways that imply the existence of others. I think, therefore, you are. And the fact that what I do and how I treat you is part of how you see yourself, of how you see your worth, your dignity, and how you treat me is part of how I see my worth and my dignity, creates a real social contract. A responsibility to each other. As Ed would say, it involves an ethic. Now, we can generate a golden rule, we can generate a categorical imperative, but the relationship is intimate. We respond to how we are treated in the world. People respond to how the world treats them. Therefore, when we are trying to repair a broken world, when we are trying to work for justice, for equality, to see the inherent dignity in others, we are involved in an intimate, political, ethical, religious, spiritual engagement and encounter with reality. We do not live alone. We do not die alone. We care about the words that we use with each other. And when we seek spiritual comfort, when we would give spiritual comfort, we are often at a loss. What shall we do? Is it okay to say spiritual? Is it okay to say comfort? What do we have to say to those who are sick? What do we have to say to those who are in despair, who are thinking of ending their lives? I've encountered this three times this week. These are awesome responsibilities we have to each other. Not necessarily for each other, but to each other. And often, as Unitarian Universalists, we are very uncomfortable feeling inarticulate, not knowing how to put into words the depth of caring, feeling frightened and frustrated that we can't take away the problem from the other person, whether they're depressed, whether they're in grief, whether they're in mourning, whatever the situation, we don't know what to say. We've got a pretty good idea for most of us what we wouldn't say, what we don't want to say. Most of us would not go up to a suffering person and say, well, God has a plan for you. Most of us would not go up to someone who had just had a loss and say, well, God needed another angel. Most of us would hesitate going up at all because we wouldn't know what to say. I have a friend who lost an adult son to an hereditary disease. And he was talking with me, and he was saying, you know, people don't mention my son anymore. They're afraid it will remind me of him. And I said to him, I laughed, I said, and there isn't a day that goes by that you don't think of him. We don't have to be worried about reminding people and bringing it back up again. Those profound experiences of love, of loss that we have had, people are aware of their entire lives. We can't take the pain away, and for most, we shouldn't. When I'm involved in a death or dying situation, I'll sometimes ask people, if I could give you a pill and you would never hurt again with the loss of this person, would you take the pill? Should you take the pill? Well, you would damn well think about it, but most wouldn't take it, because of how important and precious other people can be, and that if we are lucky, there are people in our lives that it hurts like an amputation without anesthesia when they are removed. So our job is not to fix them. Our job isn't to heal them. Our job isn't to have the exact right words. Our job to give spiritual comfort, and it's hard to do because we want the words, and it's hard often for people to accept spiritual comfort because they'll say, no, there's no point in talking about this because it won't change anything. Well, that's not true. The fact that other human beings have the time and consideration to be with us is powerful, and it is life-affirming. And it is giving spiritual comfort. The comfort of holding a hand is both physical and spiritual. When I was laying in an ICU, and it was not at all clear that I was going to live, it was an exotic little virus that closed my throat and that I can't take penicillin, and that's what they wanted to give me. The most important thing that happened was without words. My friend, Mark Bellatini, who was the editor of our hymnal and succeeded me at Star King Hayward, the first out-of-the-closet gay minister in our movement, Mark came to the hospital and he sat there in the ICU where I couldn't talk, and he simply held and stroked my hand. That, as our Quaker friends say, spoke eloquently to my condition. Sometimes we have problems with the joys and sorrows. Why are we doing this? Is it simply, if I'm of a certain mindset, it's just informational. There's nothing magical about it. Okay, you got a bell and candles, but we don't really mean it. I don't have a theology of intervention, intercessionary prayer. But I have a psychology that our focused intent to hold other people in our hearts and in our arms is hugely important and creates bonds and creates energy and somehow makes a difference. It may not change a physical outcome, but it changes the spiritual part. We are more than our words. What do we have to say to each other? I'm here. I'm here to be with you, not to fix you, not to solve your problem, but to offer company, to be good company to each other, with each other. We come together in congregations in order to celebrate, in order to share our laughter and our tears, our struggles with the world, our struggles with ourselves. We come together not as perfect people, but as people who are trying to learn how to have a certain amount of humility about what we can do and what we can't do, and a tremendous acknowledgement of the power that we have to make a difference in each other's lives. Being there, being mindful of this miracle of life that we share, being mindful of the beauty of the day, being mindful of the coming of the night, being mindful that we are in different places in those cycles, and they aren't necessarily chronological. But we are in, as the poet said, the same caravan, bound to the same destination. And as we travel, our job is to be good company, good physical company, considerate physical company, and good spiritual company. Because I think, and you are, we are, and the world is made better for all of the we-ness that we can find, celebrate, create, and sustain.